Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello and welcome to Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I am your host, Randy Sutton. We have a great show for you today. I have a special guest. His name is Dave Smith. Dave Smith is a retired police lieutenant and one of the premier police trainers in the United States today. He's going to give us some great insight. Now we're going to take a walk to the briefing room where I'm going to give you my view from the blue. Today's topic is not a happy one. It is a very difficult subject to talk about. It's one that we don't want to talk about in law enforcement. And that's what this show is all about. The show is about truth. And sometimes the truth is not so happy.
The Briefing Room. Headlines, stories, and all that touches American law enforcement.
A police officer in Austin, Texas, this week, took his own life in his patrol car. His body was found in his patrol car, and he's not the first. In fact, this year has seen several suicides while police officers have been working. It's a topic that we must discuss, because if we hide it, if we pretend it doesn't exist, then there are police officers that are working today who might choose this same path. And there is help. There is an avenue for police officers to seek help, to get help, and to get back onto the road of mental and emotional health. Let's talk about suicide for a little bit. Let's talk about some statistics, because they're very disturbing. We all know the statistics for police officers dying in the line of duty. Last year was about 124. This year, we're at about 32 police officers who have been killed in the line of duty. 16 of those have been murders. We talk about that a lot on this show. We talk about that a lot within policing. But what we don't talk about are the other deaths, the ones that are taken by their own hand. And the statistics are a little difficult, because many suicides go unreported as just that. They are reported as accidental, and that is for a number of different reasons, including the stigma that is often attached to suicide. One thing is for sure, there have been studies done, and at the very, very least, we know that more police officers die by their own hand than are killed in the line of duty. In fact, if you take the police officers who are murdered in the line of duty and you compare that to the number of police officers who commit suicide, it's roughly 4 to 5 times that amount. That's a very scary statistic. Roughly 4 to 5 times the amount of police officers who are murdered in the line of duty will take their own lives. That's a very disturbing number. And it's one that I believe we can affect if we combat this situation head on and we confront it. I've buried a number of friends who died by their own hand. And we talk about it in the back rooms. We shake our heads and we say, how could that have happened? How could I have not seen some sign? And very often there are signs, but we don't want to believe that they're there. And so we ignore them. One thing that I have found over the years is it's very, very difficult, even when you're close to someone, to talk about mental health. And police officers who of course have a very strong self-perception, if they feel emotionally wounded or psychologically wounded, they rarely admit it. And there's a couple reasons for that. One is because they don't want to appear weak. The other reason is that they don't want their department to find out about it and perhaps punish them. And that's a very real possibility. The other part of this is addiction. Addiction plays a tremendous role in the mental health and suicide rate of police officers. And this is going to be a really tough statistic for you to hear. I got this from safecallnow.org, which is an organization I've been associated with that helps police officers and first responders with addiction issues. They're very, very good. Safecallnow.org. They have a hotline. If you know someone or if you yourself are having thoughts or need help with addiction issues, go to safecallnow.org. I urge you to. There is a hotline number. There are people that want to help. But here's the really harsh reality. About 8 to 9% of the American public has addiction issues, mostly with alcohol and prescription drugs, some illegal drugs, of course. But when you look at police officers, the rate skyrockets to somewhere around 20%. Here's another scary statistic. 20% of police officers have addiction issues, mostly to painkillers, oxycodone, and others. And it's generally from on-the-job injuries. You know, I'm not even going to get into the doctors that overprescribe, but many police officers are injured in the line of duty. It happens all the time, either during physical confrontations or traffic accidents or falls when you're in foot pursuits. There's thousands of ways to get injured as a cop, and it happens all the time. And how do doctors deal with it? They prescribe pain-killing drugs, and police officers become addicted to that. That's not even considering the alcohol. The alcoholism rate is fairly substantial. There's help for these. There's help for these addictions. And if you want to contact me personally at Randy Sutton at America Out Loud, I will personally try and guide you to the help that you need. And I'm sincere when I say that. So we have this addiction issue. And that is a strong correlation to the suicide issue. And then there's another one. I've been teaching Policing with Honor seminars all over the country. And there is a tremendous correlation between the suicide rate and police officers getting into trouble, whether on or off duty. There was a study done, and this is going to blow your mind, but a police officer who gets into trouble, whether on or off duty, is 7 times more likely to commit suicide than a police officer who did not get into trouble. Now, that's a really startling statistic. And ethical behavior is one of those subjects that is also very difficult to talk about in policing, although it's probably one of the most important topics there is. You know, understanding the power that a police officer possesses can sometimes be misunderstood and therefore become abused. That leads to disciplinary issues or suspensions, and then that pushes the buttons to get into a bad place mentally and emotionally. So there's all of these factors, and I get messages from cops all over the country, and they're very, very honest about certain things, and that is their depression factors. They don't call it that in many cases. They don't say, "Hey, Randy, I'm depressed." What they do say is that they are worried, they are concerned, they don't like coming to work anymore. It's the job doesn't mean as much to them anymore because they feel that they are unappreciated. They feel that their administrations don't back them up. They feel that the anti-police sentiment is overwhelming. And all of these things play into mental health and emotional health. This is one of the aspects that is not being discussed in policing circles, and it needs to be. Administrators need to understand that police officers, if their perception is that they are not being treated fairly, even if in the administrator's minds that's incorrect, if police officers believe that, then that is the reality. And that has an effect on the police officer's mental health. So there's all of these factors involved, and these all affect the number of suicides taking place all over the country. It's a topic that I know we don't like to talk about, but we must. One of the main factors affecting police suicide is PTSD. Post-traumatic stress disorder, This is often associated with the armed forces, but it has a tremendous role in policing. PTSD is an often misunderstood psychological issue. It's sometimes brought about by experiencing a highly traumatic event, the death of a person, being under fire, witnessing the death of someone in a traffic collision. There's a lot of possible causes to it, and it's not really a highly understood condition. And one of the things that's often misunderstood about PTSD in policing is it doesn't have to be one particularly traumatic event that brings it on. In fact, there are some studies that in the correlation between what the military combat and police careers, the difference is that the military combat may be very short-lived and highly traumatic, but the police officer's career is a long-term issue, because you, for 20, 30 years, you are on the front lines of trauma. You are constantly witnessing death. You see violence on a continual basis. You see humanity at its worst, and it takes place over a long period of time. And sometimes it's almost like a glass, and you're dripping water into it, and you can take so much water, and then at a certain point, your cup runneth over, if you will, and you become, emotionally troubled, where something that didn't bother you 5 years ago really bothers you now. And these are the possible symptoms of PTSD. And it very often, if untreated and unrecognized, it can lead to into really severe mental issues, emotional issues that can lead to police suicide. I advise you, if you have an interest in this topic, there is a great website called Badge of Life, and they have tremendous amount of information about police suicide and also resources. So check it out, Badge of Life. For addiction issues, safecallnow.org. And they have a hotline. They have people that know their stuff, and there is help. And that is my view from the blue. We have a very special guest with us today. He's a gentleman that I have known for many years and respected for many years. His name is Dave Smith, and he's got quite a pedigree. I'm going to read his biography for you, because I could never possibly remember all this stuff. Former Police Lieutenant Dave Smith is an internationally known speaker, writer, and law enforcement expert. Dave attended the United States Naval Academy and then completed his degree at the University of Arizona while fighting forest fires with the Coconino Hotshots.
Excellent.
I hope I got that right.
You're dead on, perfectly.
Okay. He began his police career with the Tucson Police Department. In 1978, he joined the Arizona Department of Public Safety. As a career police officer, Dave held positions in patrol, SWAT, narcotics, training, and management. In 1980, he developed the popular Buck Savage video training series, was the lead instructor for the Caliber Press Street Survival Seminar from 1983 to 1985, and was instrumental in developing Caliber Press's Timeless Tactical Edge Officer Survival book. Dave holds numerous instructor certifications in firearms, defensive tactics, and human performance, and is a proven expert witness and consultant. He currently trains through the Winning Mind Seminars and is a regular columnist for Police Magazine, Officer.com, Police1.com. Dave's also the director of video training for the online Police One Academy. That is quite a pedigree, Dave. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Hey, my pleasure, Randy. I'll tell you what, yeah, there's an awful lot there, but it's spread over a lot of years.
Well, we probably don't want to talk about how many years now, do we?
No, we don't. No, we don't, brother.
Well, you know, Dave, I know that you are you're keeping up on everything that's going on in policing these days. And, you know, we have seen a tremendous surge in the attacks on law enforcement officers. The shootings, the murders of police officers, of course, have doubled in the last year. And you spent the majority of your career as a trainer trying to prepare police officers for these type of critical incidents and saving their own lives. Tell us a little bit about that training that you developed and how that's affected people that you know in law enforcement.
Well, you know, Randy, I got into law enforcement right out of college, but I had actually studied a lot of sports science, sports psychology, and way back then, of course, it was actually called coaching theory. It was the embryonic point of what we call that sports psychology today. And when I went through the academy, I was kind of shocked that I had coached wrestling at a small school in Tucson, and I felt like our wrestlers were being better mentally trained for a wrestling match than I was being trained to deal with conflict on the street. Later, eventually, I went to the Department of Public Safety, and I continued my education in sports psychology as an avocation. And then when I became a training officer for the state, I began to start applying this sports psychology. And this is the thing, is that this is really the golden age of human performance, yet at the same time, it's often hard to get or translate some of this stuff over to practical for us, yet we are athletes. A law enforcement officer is going to do a skill that only our life and death depends on our skill performance, or a citizen may. And so we're under far more pressure than the average athlete is performing a motor program. And I tell you, every agency, every city, every county, every state knows the high liability that comes with our performances. And now more than ever, of course, it's important that the officers have confidence in their skills and ability, believe in what they do, believe in themselves. And this all goes back to originally, you know, when I first started preaching this stuff back in the early 80s, I did get some confrontation, some conflict when I was working on the tactical edge with the brilliant Chuck Remsburg from Caliber Press at that time. Chuck, you know, was a tremendous wordsmith. And we would talk about, you know, human performance, about what cops need to do, about, you know, he coined the phrase crisis rehearsal, because we felt like visualization was just too California granola-y. And he was very concerned about cops buying into it. It's just like autogenic breathing became tactical breathing. You got to give each profession is going to coin their own phrases, their terminology for different performance tricks. And law enforcement, much to my joy, has really embraced the science of human performance. You have so many trainers out there that regularly study sports psychology, that readily study the American College of Sports Medicine's research, or National Strength Conditioning Association's research on human performance. So it's better now than it's ever been, but at the same time, you still see we do two steps forward and one step back. And in today's culture, it's tough to really talk about giving cops an edge when, as you are one of the forefront of standing against this tide of anti-law enforcement, and essentially it's anti-American, it's an anti-culture effect, but it's so hard to profess for training when training now is one of the first things cut or modified to be politically correct instead of human performance oriented.
I couldn't agree more. And I want to step back just one second. I want to tell you from a personal experience that I was an early advocate of the training that you were involved in. And crisis rehearsal was something that I don't think I've ever told you, but it saved my life. During my first fatal shooting, I had practiced crisis rehearsal. For the listeners that don't know what crisis rehearsal is, it is envisioning yourself in all kinds of crisis and always coming out the winner. And during my first major shootout, that crisis rehearsal came back to me, and I strongly believe that it was critical in my surviving that shooting. So that's a little on the personal side, but it revealed to me just how important what you taught and what you created, and how it does save lives.
Well, you know, the good thing is, of course, I don't take credit for it. And anybody who attends my training knows I gladly give you my reading list, and I never take credit for any idea. All I've done is take ideas and maybe reframe them or rename them so they're user-friendly for law enforcement. But this, there's a huge abundance of science. For instance, this crisis rehearsal visualization, it's in literature hundreds and hundreds of years old, you know, the ability for the human being to visualize themselves. And what we know now is scientifically proven. You're building a motor program. You're building that habitual response. And again, you hear all this talk, it's motor memory. Well, it's a motor program. In essence, and you're going to run that program in that context when you need it. And that visualization, what that rehearsal's done, it gives you not only the ability to run that program, but under great stress, you'll be able to run it. And that's what I said earlier, that there is no more. You're fighting for your life, Randy, and you needed to have that program run exactly the way you'd programmed it. And that's exactly what you had done. You'd done your repetitions in your mind. And what's that remarkable, that confidence ability cycle that we have, if I do my rehearsal, I do my practice, I build confidence, I see the performance, I see myself getting better, I build more confidence and more confidence cycle over and over. And that's what you have. Of course, your background, of course, with athletics and law enforcement, you knew intuitively that worked. And I think most people do when you listen or read the documentation, you go, I knew that. I just didn't have a word for that.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Let's talk about training just a little more, because I think it's one of the least really understood aspects of law enforcement. And it's probably the most critical, and it is given the least amount of attention and least amount of budget in policing around the country. I did some research not too long ago, shortly after the shooting and killing of Tamir Rice in Cleveland, the kid who came out with a toy gun, I was just curious as to how much training the police officers in Ohio receive on use of force and tactics, etc. And you're going to be shocked, Dave. They are mandated after the academy. Do you know how many hours of training they're required to have every year?
I'm assuming 8 to 12. What do they have?
This will blow your mind. 2.
Oh, wow.
2 hours. Now, here's the thing. Now, this is the opinion I want to get from you in this discussion. The police are being blamed for all of these use of force incidents, critical use of force, deadly force. And in your opinion, do you think the police officers around this country are receiving adequate training in this ever important aspect of their job?
Well, worse than that, they're getting anti-training. They're getting training that mitigates their natural ability to respond, their ability to win. Building in, imagine taking an athlete and teaching them how to clutch before they make the shot, before they make the service, before they return the service. Teach them literally how to doubt themselves, to clutch in their performance. And so many of our leadership, in fact, is embracing this bizarre training philosophy that actually builds in a sense of ambiguity and doubt into my performance when I'm going to need it most. That said, yes, I'm really concerned that we don't get enough training, that the in-service training, let's take Ohio for a minute. 2 hours, yet that state is famous for its instructor cadre. You have training officers go all over the country out of that Ohio network of training. It has literally been an instructor generation machine forever and ever, with Monadnock training. You used to have all these things out of there, all these conferences and training. And yet now you're saying, well, but if these trainers don't get to the student, there is no training. And
exactly.
And conversely, policy can dampen or extinguish. Because let's get a definition for everybody, and I think it's really important. Because, somebody will say, well, training is doing repetition, training is doing this, doing that. No, training is literally defined scientifically as the modification of performance. So anything that modifies your performance, good or bad, is training. So we can say a bad policy is bad training. We can say routine is a bad trainer. It detrains your performance. It alters your performance. How many times do we watch a video, Randy, we talk about this, where we see a guy get killed And we both look at each other and we go, who trained him to do that? Routine trained him to do it.
Right.
Because what he did in that moment was his training. His performance was his training. He had been taught a proper way to frisk or a proper way to search or a proper way to use cover. But routine had detrained him. Or else what's worse is some FTO got him in the car 10 minutes out of the academy and said, forget everything you were trained. I'll show you how us high-level operators do it. And that's what breaks my heart.
Exactly, exactly. You know, the incongruity here and the injustice is that the expectations on these officers all over the nation, the expectations are super for them, the expectations of their performance. They are expected to perform at high levels all the time. To handle their business with the greatest degree of efficiency and effectiveness. And then when something goes bad, when something happens that perhaps they overreacted or they underreacted, then who gets blamed for that? The officer.
The officer. Yeah, you know, you're hitting it right on. I mean, this is a nail that needs to get hammered to the public regularly. We can't afford to lose a fight. I see these pseudo experts on every, and don't tell me there is a pro police network, and I'm not going to say any three letter word networks because they're all three letters. Well, most of them, except for the far crazy ones. But the thing is that they bring on, I don't care if some guy was a celebrity detective 40 years ago on radio. That isn't the guy I want justifying my use of force. And for some reason, all these networks have a narrow cadre of these pseudo experts or some lawyer that was a cop for, 25 minutes. I don't know what his expertise is in training, but I hear him say patently stupid things to the American people.
Right.
Conversely, they give all kinds of airtime to these militant people who are glad to have us killed or injured without any hesitation. They want the bad guy to kick our fannies. They don't care whether we win or lose, but they don't understand. Every fight, there's no such thing as an unarmed subject if they knock that cop out. That cop brought a deadly weapon into that confrontation. That cop cannot lose. Their life and the innocent public around them, life depends on that officer winning. So when we overreact, why do we overreact? Partly because maybe I don't have confidence in the training I've been given.
Right.
So I go to the far extreme. Maybe I'm just terrified because of the ambiguity of the situation. There may be, and how many times do you see these videos, Randy? And your question is this person videoing a hovering threat? Absolutely. And they act as if this camera is just floating on some drone. No, it's being held by a subject who is towering over this officer who's in physical. And lately, you especially have been posting some remarkable videos of officers in these physical confrontations, and you're wondering, what the heck? And who's a bad guy? That officer doesn't know. And they have to win quickly. And it does seem like, yeah, he's pretty violent. You bet. You know what? American public love to watch their favorite detective beat the crap out of bad guys on TV. They don't want their local beat cop to win a fight by punching somebody. It's amazing to me. It's contradictory.
It is. You couldn't be. It's the difference between the reality and the media generated ideas. Well, let me ask you this, Dave. You know, we both served, for decades in law enforcement, and we've seen spikes in police murders. We've seen them diminish, and much. You know, I think some of the media has portrayed, in fact, I was asked this on national television the other day. They spouted the statistic that from last year's officer deaths, and they said, well, this is the safest year ever for law enforcement. You know, because they take one statistic, and that is the number of police officers that died in the line of duty. They fail to take into consideration all of the officers who were injured in the line of duty and were assaulted in the line of duty. They don't even address that. I think if I remember correctly, the statistics for police officers being assaulted per year is hovering around 50,000. Is that correct?
Yeah, 50. It has been consistently over the last 40 years, 60,000 to 80,000. I mean, you see sometimes And again, a part of it is the way records are kept. Unless an officer gets physically hurt, a lot of agencies don't report those assaults. So it is far vastly underreported. Now, and I, by the way, I just want to say I'm so thankful you're starting to show up on these programs, because you are a legitimate expert on use of force and police procedure. And God knows that's what one of the things the American public needs. I wish there was a regular TV show that gave the citizens of America a block of instruction on constitutional rights, on use of force issues, on search and seizure issues, so they understand what an officer has. Because I get so tired of watching these videos, and not only is the officer having to arrest a subject in a hostile crowd, apparently half the crowd are constitutional scholars because they're yelling about constitutional rights all the time. They need to be made aware of these things. And even some, quote, experts I hear don't, you know, that they think that fighting words depending, I don't know, why each state has different disorderly conduct statutes. But there is a lot of free speech that's not protected speech and is not fighting words or threats, these kind of things, or conduct and behaviors. But anyway, that's my personal, I get fired up on these things, you know. And Randy, you seem to always fire me up whenever we talk. I tell you what, I just quit seeing a therapist. I just talk to you and I feel cleansed and I get done.
You know, I want to tell the listeners that you're really a pioneer in a couple different ways. One, in your teaching and the tactics that you use for your teaching, and secondly, that you were one of the first to use what is sometimes called entertainment, your classes and in your training. And for the listeners that don't know who you are, Dave created a persona, and that persona was JD Buck Savage.
Buck Savage. I know you do it almost as good as I do, buddy. Yeah, crime fighter. No, and I'm quite fortunate. I continued my education in human performance and learning as part of an avocation. But I had a really great fortune. My first mother-in-law. Boy, what a history I have here. Yeah, let's don't even talk about marriages. But the thing is that my first mother-in-law was a doctor of child development at Arizona State, and so we would often discuss, you know, all the advances on human learning. And one of the things that was starting to come out in the late 70s was how you enhanced human retention. And one of the big things was, frankly, humor. Humor has a huge capacity to enlighten us, to not only enhance our understanding, but enhance our retention of information. And I know that instructors like you, a lot of people, use humor. And we intuitively do it because I think that's one of those things that we're hardwired to learn. And we're hardwired to learn. When I learn, then I assume other people learn, because I learn when I had an instructor that entertained me, made me laugh. Yeah, I just retain more. And so I think that information often can be translated so well with using wit and humor. And what Buck Savage was simply an attempt to add humor to our quarterly training videos there at the Arizona Police Training Quarterlies that we put out, and use the Buck Savage to make a safety point. You know, my partner back then, Steve Trethway, and I were working on officer safety stuff for the state, and we would always look at the officer killed. So we had on our wall the 10 deadly sins, if you remember, there, the 10 fatal errors. It depends on which chart you're looking at. But again, you know, failure to watch or control the hands, failure to do a proper search, failure to call for backup, all these things. And so one of our ideas had originally been to have this character hopefully every quarter, do some segment humorously, but refresh the officer's ideas about officer safety. You know, I had no idea it was going to be that big a hit. And man, it just took off from there. Next thing I know, I'm doing banquets as Buck Savage. I'm doing academy graduations as Buck Savage. It just went crazy.
That's awesome. I love it. Well, we're running out of time here, but would you tell the listeners about the Winning Mind and how they can contact you?
Right. Go to bucksavage.com, which is our website, or jdbucksavage.com, or and you can see our programs. I go around the country. My favorite program to do, I just love doing the Winning Mind, because I am, and in it I teach all the principles and that we've talked about today, and a lot of other ones that you know, that the human performance, belief, esteem, mission, all these things, faith, performance, all these things that go into us being winners. And it's a fun day. Again, I like to use humor. I've been doing a lot of programs. Betsy and I have been doing Beyond Off-Duty Survival, which is about not only officer safety off-duty, which you're a big advocate of, I know, hugely, but also your family safety on and off-duty. You need your family wherever you're at. You want your family to be able to take care of themselves. So this day and age, this is my mission. I know people keep saying, when are you going to retire? And I keep saying, well, when things calm down. I may be a really old man doing this at this rate, you know.
I think you are. In fact, for our listeners, Betsy Brandner Smith is also a retired law enforcement officer, and Dave's partner in life and in training. And she's a tremendous trainer. I've attended a number of her classes, and the two of you together are make one dynamic duo. I really want to thank you for being on the show, Dave, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thank you, Randy. Keep up the great job, buddy.
Thank you.
This is Police Story, the real stories from those behind the badge.
On each segment of Police Radio, I feature a story written by a police officer. And sometimes these stories are amusing, sometimes they're poignant, sometimes they're very difficult. They're traumatic. And I do that for a reason, because the gamut of policing runs all of those emotions. And so Police Story is a very special segment, because it really gives the listener a glimpse into the mind and the heart of individual police. This story was written by Police Officer Keith Bettinger of the Suffolk County Police Department, New York, and it's entitled Heaven's Little Policeman. I'm a proud member of the Shields of Long Island. The Shields is a fraternal group of police officers who live on Long Island and work for many different police departments. At each of the 6 yearly meetings, there is an Officer of the Month award, as well as a guest speaker. As the guest speaker chairperson, I had to find someone special every month. I was fortunate to find John Carlson. Through John, I met his son, Danny. At that time, John Carlson was a deputy inspector with the Nassau County, New York Police Department. He was the deputy commanding officer of the Marine Aviation Bureau. He and his wife, Kathleen, had a son named Danny. Danny was a unique child. I don't like to say he was handicapped, because what others considered handicapped never stopped Danny. John came to the Shields meeting because he had a story to tell, a story about Danny. Before Danny was born, doctors told his parents there were problems. Ultrasound showed a condition known as hydrocephalus, more commonly referred to as water on the brain. There were suggestions made to terminate the pregnancy. After a great deal of discussion, prayer, and tears, Kathleen and John decided they would have their child and love him no matter what. On June 6, 1983, Danny was born. Not only did he have hydrocephalus, but he also had spina bifida and other complications. Within an hour of his birth, Danny underwent dangerous but necessary surgery. Danny wasn't expected to survive the surgery or to live long afterward, but he did. Again, doctors told Kathleen and John that if Danny lived, he would never walk or talk. Kathleen and John never gave up hope and never stopped praying. Well, someone was listening. He grew up to be a loving, wonderful child. Danny went to school and had many friends. None of his friends looked at Danny as being handicapped. He just used special equipment to get around. And get around he did. Danny was always in the center of what was going on in the neighborhood. He competed in the New York State Games for the physically challenged for 6 years and won more than 20 gold medals. His friends from school and the neighborhood came to the games to cheer him on. Thanks to Danny, they learned to see what a person could do, not what a person couldn't do. Danny also became a youth ambassador for the March of Dimes and held the position for a number of years. He was a natural for the job. He had a warm smile and the gift of gab, a born politician. When he introduced to Michael Crawford, the star of Phantom of the Opera in New York, Danny introduced himself as the March of Dimes youth ambassador, and then asked Crawford, "What do you do around here?" Crawford looked dumbfounded, a Broadway star upstaged by a five-year-old. Helping the March of Dimes was important to Danny. He met many celebrities while doing it. Every time his photo appeared in the paper, he called his father at work and said, "Hey, Dad, I'm famous again." Having something that made him different from other children never stopped Danny or his family. He and his parents did everything other families do, maybe even more. They did the big things, baseball games, Disney World, the Smoky Mountains by helicopter. They also did the little things that are important for all families. They went out to dinner, to the movies, had family birthdays, entertained family and friends. Danny was so well known and liked that in 1994, his community invited him to be the official lighter of the village Christmas tree. Danny endured many surgeries during his childhood and always persevered. He seemed to give strength to the people around him and had an amazing sense of humor and a quick wit. At the same time, he was sensitive. He wasn't embarrassed when he was hugged and kissed in front of his friends. Danny was one of a kind. For a while, John was the commanding officer of the Emergency Services Bureau of the Nassau County Police Department. Danny loved to be around police officers, and the officers loved his visits. Like many kids, Danny wanted to be a cop. He would write his own police reports about the activities in the neighborhood. He told his parents he was going to be a police officer, just like his dad. This left John and Kathleen with a problem. As Danny was growing up, they always encouraged him to do his best. They told him he could be anything he wanted to be. He was a wonderful son with tremendous strengths. After all the encouragement they had given their son, how could they tell him the one thing he really wanted was beyond his reach? Then one day in August 1995, Danny collapsed. He stopped breathing. He had developed a heart infection. His parents called 911, and Danny's heroes, the police, responded. They came with their patrol cars and ambulances. John gave his son CPR. All the officers helped, doing whatever they could. They rushed their friend, the child who wanted to be just like them, to the hospital. Doctors did their best, but to no avail. There had been no heartbeat for 40 minutes. John was in the room with Danny, holding his hand and telling him to keep fighting. The monitor gave a few beats, and then it was over. Few people know the agony of trying to save their own child and losing. As devastated as they were, John and Kathleen decided to let Danny give the gift of sight to people in need. Doctors harvested his corneas and sent them to other hospitals. Danny, who never stopped doing nice things for other people, would now let two other people see the world through his unjaded eyes. John and Kathleen were amazed when more than 1,000 people attended Danny's wake. It seemed as if everyone came to pay their respects, his friends and relatives, the school bus drivers, his teachers from school, and of course his special friends, his police officers. They all came to say goodbye to their friend. The day of Danny's funeral was a typical hot summer day on Long Island. Danny received full police honors. Members of the Emergency Service Bureau were his pallbearers. Rows of police officers stood at attention and saluted while the bagpipes played. School crossing guards stood in the formation at the entrance to the church. A police motorcycle escort led the procession to the cemetery. When they entered the cemetery, a special honor guard of mounted officers and an honor guard of his friends from emergency services met him. All the officers were saluting and crying. Heaven's Police Department had just appointed a special little police officer. Funeral, Kathleen and John wanted to share Danny with the people who received his eyes. They contacted the eye bank and asked if a meeting could be arranged. is a complicated task and it takes time. It's also the recipient's decision whether or not to meet the family. After a while, a letter arrived. A young man, one of the recipients, wanted to meet Kathleen and John. He wanted to thank them for allowing Danny's cornea to be donated, for giving him the gift of sight. Kathleen and John wanted to let this young man know what a wonderful child Danny had been. When they met this man, Ray, they realized once again that God and Danny work in mysterious ways. Ray was about to lose the sight in one eye due to an infection. Danny's cornea saved not only Ray's sight, but his job as well. You see, Ray is a New York City police officer. Kathleen and John looked at one another and knew Danny, their special child, finally got the job he always wanted in his own unique way. Danny is working the streets as a police officer, just as he's always wanted. I want to take a moment and introduce you to my friend, Captain James Dillon. He is a retired Las Vegas police captain, and he's the owner of NevadaSafes.com. If you have a gun, you need a safe. If you have jewelry that you want to keep away from people that you don't want to have it, you need a safe. And the place to get it is Nevada Safes. It's located in Las Vegas at 5250 West Charleston. And it's the Southwest United States' largest safe warehouse. He's got Liberty, he's got American Security, he's got Winchester. If there's a manufacturer of a safe, well, they're represented by him. You got to take a look at his inventory. He can deliver all over the Southwest. And his phone number is 702-331-SAFE. That's 702-331-SAFE. NevadaSafes.com. Give Jim a call. This is End of Watch. Each week on this program, we honor the lives of those police officers who have lost their lives in the line of duty. This week, we honor a U.S. Border Patrolman, Jose Daniel Barraza. He was with the Border Patrol for almost 8 years, and on April 18th, 2016, he lost his life in the line of duty in a traffic accident. His end of watch, Monday, April 18th, 2016. Rest in peace. I want to thank you for listening to Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. I really do appreciate you listening, and if you have any questions, comments, if you'd like to submit a story, if you're a active duty, retired, or former police officer, and you want to submit a story to the police story segment of this, contact me, send me an email and the story at randysutton@americaoutloud.com. And also, Facebook. Go to my Facebook page. I do a lot of communication over there. Look at Randy Sutton, public figure. I love your comments. I love your questions. I look forward to your comments, your questions. If there's something you want me to mention on the air about a particular topic, let me know. And we'll see if we can't work it into a segment somewhere. Thanks again. And take care.